Okay, some more about NMR spectroscopy. You know, there's another way to do NMR spectroscopy, which is to do a bunch of problems, to look at spectra and try to interpret them, or to predict spectra from compounds. There are plenty of problems in the book to try that on, but what I'm focusing on in lecture is more understanding how NMR works. I think that, you know, if you ever have to use NMR, as you may do in lab, you'll get onto it pretty soon. The ideas of interpreting spectra are pretty straightforward, but the understanding of NMR is a little more subtle, and that's what I'm spending my time on here. First, a correction from last time. We talked about what influence on the spectrum of a nucleus, like the red one up at top here, you'd get, the field that that nucleus sees, from circulation of electrons on some other nucleus. Circulation of electrons about the nucleus in question is clear. It'll make something that opposes the applied field. But how about from other nuclei? And here we showed the direction of the field from circulation on the blue nucleus as seen by the red nucleus. But I made a mistake, and it was found by the people working on the wiki, for which I'm grateful, that the ones down here, these yellow ones, I had drawn backwards. They should be parallel to the lines of force shown there. So I think I said in the heat of the moment that those canceled one another, but they don't cancel, right? They give the more or less horizontal ones have a net downward field from the whole bunch of them. But what I said was true, which is that if you average over a whole sphere all the possible orientations of that bond, then the effect is zero and you can forget it. Okay, and this is true of interactions of dipoles all the time. Incidentally, there was a mistake in the wiki I noticed. They talked about these as if it were electric charges, these fields. You know, the line of force is the direction of force on an electric charge. But the magnets don't feel a force. They feel a torque. Because magnets are intrinsically not polar, they're dipolar. You can't have just the north pole of a magnet. They always come as a pair, north and south. So there's never any net force on them, right? What there is a torque. It tries to twist it to make the north point north and the south point south. So it's a twisting that's involved, not a force that would lead to translation. Okay, but anyhow, whenever you have interactions of dipoles, like here we had a dipole caused by orbiting, and we're looking at it with our nuclear dipole, and we notice that as we rotate the sample, the direction that this field exerts on this one changes from being in that direction to being in that direction. Okay, and the same thing is true of two nuclei. If you have two nuclei that are linked by a bond somehow, and the thing can tumble, you get force that, or you get a field that points one way or points the other way. And again, if you average over all possible rotations, it averages to zero. Right, so you don't have to worry about it. Except, there's a little bit of interaction between the two that doesn't come from that source. It doesn't come from the through-space interaction of the lines of force from this one influencing the field seen by this one. There's another way that the two nuclei can communicate with one another, and that leads to isotropic. That is, it doesn't get averaged to zero. The part that's isotropic, the part that's anisotropic that depends on orientation, averages to zero. But the parts that's isotropic that doesn't depend on orientation doesn't get averaged to zero when things tumble. And that it's a neat mechanism that gives rise to that. It's mediated by the bonding electrons, and we're going to show a little bit about that. And that's what I just said. The anisotropic through space part averages to zero. So it's not what you would think. Here's a table from the book that shows different pairs of protons and how strong their magnetic interaction is. That's measured by how much those peaks get split, because the field that's seen by this proton is influenced by the other proton over here, which could be either one way or the other. But the mechanism doesn't come through space, and you can see that very easily here by looking at the first three molecules. Here are anti a pair of protons across a double bond. They have a big splitting, 12 to 18 hertz, a big interaction. Those that are syn to one another have 6 to 12, a smaller interaction. And the ones that are on the same carbon have the smallest interaction of all, 0 to 3. But if you look at the distance between them, the distances are in exactly the opposite order. You would expect the opposite influence from how close they are to one another. So clearly something different is going on. It's not through space interaction. And remember, that's anisotropic and averages to zero. So there's something else going on. And what is it that gives rise to this splitting, which therefore you can use to interpret something about the structure if you understand it? The magnitude of the splitting tells you something about the relationship between those two protons. For example, in this case, just empirically, once you had measured a bunch of spectra, if you found that trans olefins have this splitting and cis olefins have this splitting, then you could use that to distinguish between cis and trans. Can you think of any other way of distinguishing between cis and trans double bonds? How you can tell whether it's cis or trans? I'm giving you a hint. IR. Remember the active IR mode when the two protons are moving together? One is high frequency and the other is low frequency? We talked about that. That was way before vacation, right? You don't remember that anymore. But it'll come up again sometime. Okay, so that's one. You can do it by IR, but here you can do it by NMR too. And you can do it just empirically by having studied a lot of them and noticed that one has big splitting and one small. But why? What does it have to do with if it's not distance between them? So it's not spatial proximity. The through-space interaction averages to zero on tumbling. Okay. Now, let's look at that molecular orbitals of here ethane, but it has the same property that's relevant. Here is the HOMO minus 3. Okay. Now, there are going to be a pair of electrons in that. Right? Now, that pair of electrons, one, they're magnetic. One's pointing up, one's pointing down. Right? Now, the nucleus is also magnetic. Right? The interaction between the nucleus and the electron should average to zero all over all possible orientations, except for one position of the nucleus of the electron. Where could the electron be that it wouldn't average to zero as a molecule tumbles? On the nucleus. So to the extent that one electron is on the nucleus, it can be with or against the nuclear magnet, and that's favorable or unfavorable. Right? So of those two electrons that are in the bond, one of them will prefer to be near that nucleus. Right? To be on that nucleus. It doesn't spend very much time there, but that's its maximum density, remember? Okay, so but when the up electron of that in that molecular orbital is on nucleus A, then only the down electron is available to be on nucleus B, right? And they have a magnetic interaction when that other electron is on nucleus B. And this is an indirect way that nucleus B knows what nucleus A is. Right? It's through the two electrons that are in bonds that are involved, that orbitals that involve those two. But because it involves the orbitals, the interactions of these, the mixing of the AOs to give these molecular orbitals, it depends on the overlap between those two. The overlap between this and this is going to help determine how strongly this nucleus knows what that nucleus is doing by virtue of these messengers, the electrons that are paired in the bond. Okay, so in tumbling molecules, nuclear spins communicate not through space, but through paired electrons when they are actually on the nuclei a small fraction of the time. Okay. Now, might it be that the reason this coupling is bigger than that coupling, this interaction between the nuclei is bigger than this, is because there's better overlap here than there is there? that could be a possibility. So let's check it out. This is sort of fun to do. Okay, so which one should have better overlap? Well, we can tell the overlap between hybrid orbitals by looking at the overlap of their components. Okay, so let's split those into components. You see, this pair of orbitals is made up of this pair plus this pair, right? If you take these up and add them to that, you can see that they're like this, blue here and red here, blue, red, blue here, red here. Okay, right? So this is the sum of whatever this overlap was plus whatever this overlap was. Okay, that's where it came from. And analogously over here, except we've changed the signs in order to make the hybrid orbitals point the way they show up there. Okay? Now, the overlap of the pi orbital is the same here as it is here. But the overlap of the sigma orbital is different here and here. Which one is favorable, left or right? Which is the favorable overlap, this one or that one? Left. Okay. This turns out to be wrong. It's really interesting. I'm going to show you this. Okay, now this is made up of these two s orbitals plus these two p orbitals. Everybody see that? You add this to this and you get that. You add this to this and you get that. Okay? Now, this overlap is favorable. This overlap is favorable. Right? So that looks good. This overlap is bad. That overlap is bad. That looks like it's going to be bad. Okay, that's good S with S, bad S with S. Good P with P, bad P with P. So everything is looking like you were right, right? This is good and this is bad. What have we forgotten? What we've forgotten is that this S can overlap with this P and this S can overlap with that P when you put them together. Okay? So those are bad, this S overlapping with that P. That is, the S part of this, which is red, overlapping with the P part of this, which is blue on this side and red on this side. That's bad, and same the other direction, right? Over here, you have good S with P and good S with P. Now, which is more important in overlap? S with S, P with P, or S with P? Remember this curious thing we saw last semester, right? Is that S with P is a bigger overlap than S with S or P with P. So this is the part that dominates. And in fact, this overlap, curiously to say, is bigger than this overlap. So this one is better than that. So this one has a bigger coupling constant than that one does. Isn't that interesting? It really, when you draw pictures like that, you wouldn't imagine that that's the way it is. But it's true, and you can see it when you draw it out this way. So anti-overlap is better than syn overlap for this reason. Okay, that's not key to understanding organic chemistry altogether, but I think it's so cute that I wanted to mention it to you. Okay, now let's look at some others. This is also taken from the book figure 15.42. And it says at the top, identical hydrogens do not couple. Right? So you don't see any splitting of two hydrogens on the same carbon like that. But that's not true. Right? What's true is that the light, that the peaks that would show the splitting don't appear in the spectrum. Because light cannot interact with the molecule in a way that shows that. And I'll show you some more of that shortly in frame 11. Okay, so that, but, and then the other interesting one is this one, that the coupling between these two depends on conformation on the phase of rotation about that carbon-carbon bond. And that won't surprise you from what we just saw in the previous slide, right? If these are anti to one another, that it can vary from 2 to 13 hertz depending on conformation, right? So if they're anti, it's big. It's 13 hertz because anti is the best overlap, right? If they're perpendicular to one another, it's very little interaction, right? Only two hertz. If they're syn to one another, it's not quite as big as when they're anti, because the overlap isn't as good, for, as we saw in the previous slide. So it's 11 hertz. And what this means is, if they're gauche to one another, which is, of course, a very common arrangement, then it's about 7 hertz. So that's the most likely coupling you see from hydrogens on adjacent carbons is a splitting of about 7 hertz, right? Because they're gauche to one another. Or, conceivably, because they're rotating and averaging and giving about 7. Okay? But this is an approximate way to measure a torsional angle. Right? If you look at the NMR spectrum and see how big that splitting is, it tells you approximately at least what that angle is between those hydrogens that you're looking at. Okay, now, so here's a peak. It looks like it has just a little bit of splitting, right? Now, I'm going to amplify the spectrum 30 times, right? And you see some other peaks. Now, this one turns out to be nothing. That's something in the electronics of the spectrometer that gave this sort of ghost image, right? But these are real peaks. So there are satellites on the peak that we saw. What do those arise from? It's a splitting of 126 hertz. So 10 times as big as these splittings between hydrogens on adjacent carbons. Okay? And that's coupling between the proton and the C13 nucleus. Remember, only 1% of carbon is C13, right? But in those few molecules that have a C13 attached to the proton whose signal you're looking at, half of them, half a percent, will be that C13 up, half of them will be down, right? So you'll get these two peaks that are each half a percent as big as the main peak. So if you really blow it up, you can see those. Now, because 99% of the sample is C12 and gives this enormous peak in the middle, right? But this has you can get something interesting about molecular structure from there, according to this paper from 1959, that the splitting has to do with the S character of the carbon atomic orbitals that are used to make the bond. Why? Because that pair of electrons, which communicates between the proton and the C13, can only sense the nucleus when it's on the nucleus, not if it's near the nucleus, because if it's only near, then tumbling averages it to zero. But if it's on the nucleus, then tumbling doesn't do that. But you're only going to be on the nucleus of a carbon to the extent that you're in an S orbital of the carbon. So it depends on how much S character there is in the bond. And here's an example, a table taken from that paper. So here are a bunch of different carbons that are sp3 hybridized, and you see the magnitude of the magnetic interaction between carbon and hydrogen is all about 120 to 130. But if you go to the aromatic carbons, benzene, or to cyclopropane, where the hybridization is about sp squared, then it's a bigger coupling constant because it's more S character, right? And if you go to an acetylene bond, where it's an sp hybrid, then it's a still much larger coupling. So you can measure the hybridization of the carbon that's bonding to a hydrogen by the magnitude of the splitting of these very tiny satellite peaks that come from the molecules that have C13 in them. Now, just a word about the units that are used to measure chemical shift, delta, and J, the coupling constant. They're different units. Delta is measured in parts per million. That's a fraction, a fractional unit. Whereas J is measured in energy, in hertz, frequency. Now, why don't you measure chemical shift in energy, right? The difference in frequency of where these peaks appear. And we've already mentioned this in passing, but I'll show you again. Here are two spectra of the same substance. It's from the book, taken at different spectrometers. One has a field five times as large as the other, and each of them is plotted on a certain graph paper that's used by that spectrometer. Now, let's make the plots so that they have a common energy scale, common frequency scale. Okay, so we got to compress the one, right? So that now these two charts have the same frequency scale, but this, and we're going to line them up so that TMS, tetramethylsilane, our reference is a zero in both cases. But you see the position of this peak that we're looking at is different in the two cases. It's much higher here than it is here. In fact, it's five times as large in the splitting. Why is it bigger? Because the amount of that orbiting, which is what caused the shift, the orbiting of the electrons, is proportional to how big the field is. So if you make the field five times as big, you make the orbiting five times as big, and the energy shift is five times as big. Right? So then if you plot that way, if you plot a frequency scale, right, then you have to tell people what spectrometer you're using, because you're going to get a different spectrum with different spectrometers, different strengths of magnets. But if you plot it instead on parts per million scale, what the fractional shift is, then it's the same in the two cases, because it's multiplied by 5 automatically if you do it as a fraction rather than in terms of energy. So that's why chemical shift is reported in parts per million, so that it doesn't make any difference what spectrometer you measure it on. You always get the same fractional chemical shift. Now that's different for the interaction between nuclei, because their interaction doesn't have anything to do with the applied magnetic field. It's just a certain strength, a certain energy, right? So that you measure in terms of frequency. Now let's look at these, at the coupling, at the pattern from these two hydrogens in this compound. They're anti, so they have a big coupling constant. So one has this chemical shift, one has this chemical shift, and each peak is split into two according to whether the other proton is up or down. Okay, in that, so there's the difference in chemical shift, and there's the difference in frequency. But notice something. These peaks are not equal in height, whereas we know that the Boltzmann population of up and down is almost exactly one. It's only a very, very tiny excess of one over the other, right? So what's the reason for this asymmetry in the height of these doublets, which you would think would be within our ability to measure it one to one? You can see that here in figure 14.9 of the book, which is a similar spectrum, two protons mixing with one, coupling to one another, but measured at different fields. So that if our scale is in energy, the chemical shift will get smaller and smaller as we get, in terms of energy, as we get smaller fields. Right? So the chemical shift gets smaller as we lower the frequency of the spectrometers. We use a cheaper spectrometer, not such a big magnet. Now look at how the pattern changes as we do this. There's the difference in delta at high field, in a high field spectrometer. And there's J, the magnitude of the coupling constant, or the spin-spin splitting. And here it is at a much smaller field, the J, but now the delta is very much smaller. It's the weighted average of these two. It's right here. This one's bigger than that one, so it counts more in the average, right? And when you get down to a really small field, there's no difference at all. But look at how the pattern changes. Right? Look at those outer peaks. They get weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker, and they disappear when there's no difference in chemical shift. Right? And the reason for that is that the ability of the light to interact with the protons and cause them to precess and shift and so on disappears when the chemical shifts get smaller. So it's not that J goes away. The magnetic interaction between the protons is always the same strength, right? What goes away is the spectrometer's ability to see that peak, right? And when the chemical shift difference becomes zero, then you don't see the flanking peaks at all, so it disappears. Remember, that's what the book says, that there is no coupling between those. It's not that there's no coupling, it's that you can't see it. The peaks go away. Okay, because we've measured delta here in hertz, right? So by increasing this difference, by using a big magnet, you reduce the asymmetry and you go from a very hard pattern to see to one that's toward one that's exactly what you expect, 1-to-1 and 1-to-1. So you get the spectra become easier to interpret when you use a higher field spectrometer, and that's one of the reasons you do it. And also in order to get peaks that are near one another to be far apart by increasing the chemical shift difference measured in frequency units. It's always the same fractionally, but if it's a fraction of a very weak field, it's not very much, and you can't see the difference between the peaks. Okay, so that's one of the advantages of using a high field spectrometer. You get ideal patterns. So here you see in the case of ethanol, we have a triplet here, because that H and these H's both have two hydrogens on the neighboring carbon, 1-to-2-to-1, as we talked about last time. So triplet, triplet. In the middle, you have a quartet, like 1-to-3-to-3-to-1, made up of doublets. So this one goes with that one, 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 which are due to splitting. The quartet is splitting of this signal by these three, and the doublet is splitting by that one. But notice something sort of cute here, that they slope up, they're distorted, and they slope up toward the partner that's doing the splitting. So if it were a confusing case and you didn't know which other hydrogen was causing the splitting, you could use that asymmetry to see which direction it is from the signal you're looking at. Okay, and then the doublets are sloped here in the opposite direction because this is the one that's causing the split. And if you look at figure 1553 in the book, you'll see three spectra taken at different fields, and you can see how much simpler the spectrum gets when you use a high field. Okay, now, one of the most interesting things about NMR is what it tells you about things happening in time, about dynamics. So we're going to talk about the NMR time scale and something related to it, which is called decoupling. Okay, and you can read about it in the book there. So here's that ethanol spectrum again. Now, what's the chemical shift of the hydrogen on the OH? Well, we can look at the peak here and see it's at 5.3. That's its chemical shift, right? But the book has some other spectra of ethanol as well in figure 1553. And here's the OH appearing at 2.3, and here's the same OH appearing at 1.8. It's different in these different samples. OH doesn't have a fixed chemical shift. Why not? It's because it's the average from many different structures. The OH can be hydrogen bonded, and that hydrogen bonding affects its chemical shift. But the amount of hydrogen bonding depends on the concentration, depends on the temperature. So you get different chemical shifts for different samples. So OH can appear any place in the spectrum between about delta 1 and delta 6, depending on concentration and temperature. But that, of course, you don't have hydrogen bonding for the CHs, right? So they have the same chemical shift here and here and here, here and here and here. Now, but look at the pattern. This is a triplet, clearly, right? But these don't look like triplets. What's going on with the spin-spin splitting of the OH signal? Well, here there are three OH peaks, and bear in mind that they come from three different kinds of molecules. The reason is that this peak is coming from molecules where the two hydrogens on the central carbon are both pointing with the field. This is coming from those molecules where they're both against the field. And the central line is coming from where one is up and the other is down, or one is down and the other is up. That's why it's 1-to-2-to-1, as we talked about last time. So those three signals are coming from H's, OH's, on three different classes of molecules. But an interesting thing about the H is it's acidic, the OH. So it can jump from molecule to molecule. So sometimes it's on molecules that would give that peak. Sometimes it's molecules that would give that peak. Sometimes it's molecules that will give that peak. And if it jumps rapidly from one to another, you'll see the average. Right? And these are averaged by jumping from molecule to molecule. So it's the average for exchange among many molecules. And how rapidly exchange depends on how much acid you got there, because, you know, jumping from molecule to molecule, the acid helps. It protonates OH, and then the other H can leave and go to another molecule. So acid makes it faster, and certain solvents help slow it down. So you can get a spectrum like this if you use a solvent that's hydrogen bonded but not acidic, so it holds the thing in place. Okay, but now here's an interesting puzzle then. Remember we saw this spectrum from the patent of Paxil, and saw that there were two peaks here in the IR for the OH that wasn't hydrogen bonded and the OH that is hydrogen bonded. Now, what's weird about this in light of what we've just been saying? Can you see? Henry? Yeah, why doesn't this average out? Because obviously hydrogen bonds are easy to make and break. So you should get averaging and see a single average peak the way we did in NMR. For the OH of ethanol. So the question is, why doesn't IR show averaging of the OH signals? Now, this particular sample is a solid, so you could imagine that in a solid, it's not easy for the molecules to move and change their environment. But exactly the same thing happens if you do it in solution. You see two different peaks for hydrogen-bonded and not hydrogen-bonded OHs in IR when you don't see it in NMR. What's the difference? Well, notice that these two peaks, one of them is at 110 times 10 to the 10th hertz, that's this wave number, and the other one is at 102 times 10 to the 10th hertz. So the difference in the frequencies that they're vibrating, the hydrogen bonded and the not hydrogen bonded, the difference in these two frequencies is 10 to the 11th per second. So a very big difference in frequency. Okay? Now, what does that have to do with it? Well, how long does it take if you want to measure a frequency precisely? How do you measure the frequency? You see whether light will interact with the thing that's vibrating. And then you adjust the frequency of the light so it exactly matches the frequency of vibration, and then it can get absorbed. But how long do you have to measure to see that the match is precise? Okay. So suppose you had two different bonds, or whatever, one that was vibrating at 20 hertz and another that was vibrating 21 times a second, right? And you're going to use light to match it, and you'll know there's a match because when it matches, it'll interact with light and absorb the light. Okay, so we take light that's 20 hertz and it exactly matches the frequency and it gets absorbed. So we know that's fine, it's 20 hertz. Now, what would happen if we used that same light and tried to match 21 hertz, the other vibrating thing? But suppose we only used a short pulse of light, of the 20 hertz light. It matches just about as well. So it would be absorbed. Okay? However, if we used a longer pulse of light, if we used a light that went for a whole second, then we sample all the possible relative phases between the vibrating thing and the light. We have favorable ones, but we have just as many exactly unfavorable ones, right? And averaged over the whole second, there's no interaction, right? So the light would not interact with that one. So then if we wait long enough, if we wait for a whole second, we can tell the difference between 20 hertz and 21 hertz with this light that we're using. A short pulse won't discriminate, but a pulse that's a second long will tell the difference. Everybody see how that works? Because it depends on whether you go long enough to tell whether it matches or not. Okay, a 1 second pulse samples the full range of phases. Therefore, there's no net interaction with light, just as much favorable as unfavorable. And so a 1 second light pulse then is able to distinguish between something that vibrates at 20 hertz and something that vibrates at 21 hertz. Now, suppose we had 22 hertz. Okay? Now, we sample all the complete variety of phases. But in fact, we would sample the complete range of phases in only half a second for this one, right? To go from in phase to exactly out of phase to back in phase again, right? But we can do it in a shorter time, in only half a second, whereas this one took a whole second to do it because there was a difference, bigger difference in frequency here, right? So a half a second, that is 1/1 the difference in frequency. The difference in frequency is 2, right? 2 seconds. They're 2 hertz. 1/1 that is a half a second. So in half a second, we could tell the difference. So 1/1 delta nu is long enough to sample the full range, favorable and unfavorable, and therefore to know that it's not matched up. Okay. So to be able to distinguish two things, you have to have a pulse of light. You have to run your experiment a length of time that's 1/1 the difference in frequency. Okay. Now, suppose that the protons are exchanging their sites faster than that 1/1 the difference in frequency. Suppose their difference in frequency was 10 hertz, right? But they're jumping back and forth between two sites where they're precessing faster or precessing slower. They're jumping back and forth 10 times a second, right? Then what do you see? Well, let's look at the bottom here. Suppose you had a little run of 22 hertz, and then it changed and became 20 hertz, and then it became 22 hertz again, jumping back and forth, and then 20, and then 22, and then back to 20 again. Okay, so that's the wave that you see of the precession, right? Now, that doesn't match with 22 hertz, the underlying faint green line doesn't match with that. It wouldn't absorb that. Right? But if you use the average, which is 21 hertz, the average of 22 and 20, then it stays pretty well in phase all the time. Right? So now you'll absorb light that's the average frequency. Isn't that cute? So it depends on whether you jump back and forth between two different sites that have different frequencies. If you jump back and forth faster than the difference in frequencies, then you get an average. But if it's slower, you see them independently.
Would you have to jump back and forth at a constant rate?
No. Then notice this isn't constant. Some of these are slow and some are rapid. But on average, they're a certain frequency, and you stay, therefore, in phase with whatever that average frequency is. Okay. So when do peaks average? When the atoms don't stay put long enough to tell their difference in frequency. That is, if two peaks differ by 100 hertz, you have to count for 1/100 of a second to tell them apart, 1/1 the difference in frequency. Now, these two IR peaks that did not get averaged, remember we said they differed by 10 to the 11th hertz. So you don't change the hydrogen bonding pattern 10 to the 11th times a second. Maybe you do it 10 to the 8th or even 10 to the 9th per second, but you don't do it 10 to the 11th per second. So since it's not jumping back and forth rapidly enough, 10 to the 11th per second, you see it as a single peak. But in the NMR, these two differ by only maybe 100 hertz or something like that. Right? And then all you have to do is jump back and forth 100 times a second. So it's because the two different techniques, NMR and IR, have very different frequencies, very different differences in frequencies, that one shows a single average peak and the other shows separate peaks for the two different things. So IR is a much quicker technique. It sees shorter time things. It's like a stop-action photo in IR, whereas NMR has much lower frequencies and therefore is much more averaged. Okay, so for example, consider cyclohexane. You have an axial proton and an equatorial proton. They should have different chemical shifts. And indeed they do, but when you look at the spectrum, you see a single line. Why? Sonny? Why don't you see one peak for axial hydrogens and another for equatorial? Right, it's the chair is flipping back and forth, and it's averaging, and it's flipping back and forth faster than the difference in frequency that corresponds to the chemical shift for the axial and the equatorial in this particular spectrometer. So there's one average chemical shift, and no splitting is observed because all the protons have the same chemical shift. And remember, when they have the same chemical shift, you don't see splitting. Right? But you can do a neat trick. You can make cyclohexane that has just one hydrogen on it. All the others are deuterium. And you do that so that you won't see any splitting from the other. You're just looking at the one hydrogen. You're not, the others are not affecting it. Okay, but it can be either equatorial or axial. And this is the equatorial peak, and that's the axial peak. Now, why can you see it here when you couldn't see it in the previous spectrum? Why can you see two peaks here rather than the average? Because it's measured at minus 89 Celsius. And at that low temperature, the flipping back and forth is slow on the compared to this difference in frequency. This difference in frequency is 29 hertz. Now look what happens as you warm it up. Right? And here at minus 60 Celsius, it coalesces to go from two peaks to one peak. And that's when the flipping, the rate of changing axial to equatorial, is about 30 times a second, right? The difference in frequency of the two. So that's what's called the NMR time scale. And using a different spectrometer, a higher field spectrometer, would give a bigger difference in frequency. And therefore, you could measure faster things. It would take more, faster flipping to average a bigger splitting. So that's a neat way to measure rates of reactions, very, very fast reactions, using the shape of the line in the NMR spectrum. Now, one last practice thing here for, I'm not assigning a bunch of problems. You might want to do a few, and probably you're doing some in lab as well about interpreting spectra. But this is an example of something I expected people to be able to answer on a test a few years ago. So here was this particular compound. It's a hemiacetal, and it can be made by reacting an aldehyde with the isopropyl alcohol using acid or base catalysis. We talked a little bit about that already, and we'll talk more about it later. But the question two here is the one that's relevant. You're supposed to sketch the NMR spectrum you would expect for this compound, saying a few words about your selection of chemical shift and splitting pattern for each of the six labeled sets of protons. So we're going to do this as a group here. Okay, so group A, that OH, what do you expect for its chemical shift? You remember the idea is that chemical shift, zero is TMS, has a lot of electrons around the proton, right? And then it goes down to lower field, right? To by the time you get to benzene, it's about 7 or something like that, 8. Okay? So what do you expect for OH in terms of a chemical shift? This is, in fact, a trick question. What? Between 1 and 6. Remember, it depends on concentration, depends on temperature. So that's going to be different values. Almost any place between 1 and 6, depending on concentration, temperature, because it's averaged over different amounts of hydrogen bonding. Okay, now how about the splitting? How about the spin-spin splitting? Should it be a doublet, a triplet, a quartet, a doublet of quartets, or whatever? What determines the splitting pattern that you get at that chemical shift? Mike? How many protons there are on adjacent atoms, right? So what are you going to see? Okay, so here there's one proton here, so this could be a doublet. But it's not likely to be a doublet. It's much more likely to be a singlet because it averages the OHs by jumping from molecule to molecule. So if it stayed on a single molecule, some of them would be on molecules where that neighboring hydrogen was up. Some would be on molecules where it's down. You'd see two peaks. But if it's jumping rapidly from molecule to molecule, faster than the difference in frequency, then you see a single peak. And that's what we saw usually for alcohols. So probably there's no splitting because of rapid proton exchange. Okay, so that's sort of a trick one, the first one. Now how about B? What should the chemical shift? Another thing I'm not asking here is how big the peaks are, right? But that's pretty obvious. One proton is one area, two protons is two, three protons is three. That wasn't worth wasting time on the test. But how about the chemical shift for that? Should it be a normal alkane, or is there anything that would make it different? Derek? Right, there are oxygen, there's an oxygen, two oxygens in the vicinity. Not right on the same carbon, but on the next carbon. So it'll be shifted downfield a little bit. It'll be slightly deshielded by two oxygens on the neighboring carbon. Right, so it's sort of a remote effect, but still it'll shift it down. So it might be someplace in the range of 1 to 2. And a real compound that has a structure like that locally has 1.3. Okay, you weren't expected to know that. Okay, how about the splitting for this one? Should it be a single peak, a double peak, triplet, quartet? Brian? Right, there's one hydrogen on the next atom, so it should split it into a doublet. Okay, a one-to-one doublet, and the splitting should be about 7 hertz. That's the standard splitting between neighboring things if they're gauche. Okay. How about C? What should it show? How about its chemical shift? Mayrov, you got an idea? How about the electron density on that? Should it be higher or lower than on this CH3? Any ideas? It would be deshielded because of the oxygens. Would it be deshielded, this hydrogen, more or less than those hydrogens? Is it closer to the oxygens or further?
Yeah.
It's much, much closer. They're on the same carbon, right? So this is deshielded by two oxygens on the same carbon. So it comes down at 4 to 5, not at 1 to 2, right? And a real compound that has something like that, there's a real compound that's 4.7, okay? And now, what should its splitting be? If this one affects these, then these must affect this. And there are three of them there. They can all be with, all against, one with, one against, blah, 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 blah. Right? So it's going to be 1 to 3 to 3 to 1 quartet. Okay? Now, how about group D? Somebody else here? Sunwa? How about D? Should it be upfield, downfield, where? Normal alkane. Pardon me? Slightly deshielded, because there's an oxygen not on this carbon, but on the next carbon. Okay, it'll be slightly deshielded, someplace around 1, and there's a real analog that has 1.1. How about the splitting of this one? A doublet, because there's one hydrogen on the neighboring carbon. So, one-to-one doublet, something like 7 hertz splitting. Okay, how about E? Brian, what do you say? Yeah, because it's got oxygen on the same carbon. Right, so it's going to be downfield further, deshielded by oxygen on the same carbon. But less than this one. Because this one had two oxygens on the next carbon, on the same carbon, pardon me. So about 4, there's a real analog that's 3.8. And how about splitting for that one, Brian? You're right, there are 6 hydrogens, right, on the neighboring carbons. So that means there are 7 lines, and it's the binomial, whatever it is, 1 to 7 to blah, 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 I don't know, or 1. Is it 1 to 6? Anyhow, it's lots. Right? It's a complicated 7-line pattern. Okay, splitting about 7 hertz. And finally, F. Okay. Richard?
Very similar to D.
Very similar to D. Okay, so it should have about slightly deshielded, right? And the splitting? Is it exactly the same as D? You say it's pretty similar. Is it exactly the same? Pardon me? It can rotate, yeah?
I was going to say it's identical because of rotation about the CO bond.
Everybody agree? Victor?
Hi.
Yeah. Here's something that's interesting. This carbon is relevant. What the hell does that carbon have to do with that, the signals out here? What's special about that carbon? It's chiral. These two methyls are diastereotopic. This was the trick in the question, right? To get the last point on the question, you had to get that. Okay? No one got it. Who's surprised? You're surprised that no one got it?
No, I didn't.
No, but that's very interesting. Yeah.
For the splitting on C, we don't really care about the hydrogen on the hydroxide group because it could fall off.
Because when you're looking at this carbon, you're trying to measure that hydrogen. When you're looking at it, this neighbor is not a single hydrogen. Sometimes it's one hydrogen, then another one comes on and it goes off. Another one comes on. So it sees all different hydrogens there. Some up, some down. They average to zero if it's happening fast. But if you choose a special solvent like dimethyl sulfoxide, it won't exchange rapidly, and then you'd see a doublet. And be very careful there's no acid in there. Okay, so you see how you can do this. And the other way to do it is to look at a spectrum and try to figure out what it is. And that's where we'll stop for now.